supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, the Philadelphia Bicycle Coalition crunches the numbers on traffic fatalities in the city. First, a former Philadelphia assistant district attorney now wants to take over the top slot in that office. Details from WHYY's Tom McDonald.
Beth Grossman says there are too many Democrats in top city government posts, and she's running as a Republican as a way to offer some balance.
Common sense tells us that it is far too much power in too few hands for far too long. Even people who come to office meaning well can fall victims to the temptations that come with such unchallenged power.
Grossman ran the controversial civil forfeiture unit in the DA's office. It was in charge of seizing properties allegedly connected to drug transactions. She defends the work she did there.
That unit focused on dealing with drug properties that are lowering property values on a street, creating public safety issues for children who have to walk to school every day going past those doors, for dangerous bars where people were shooting each other and dealing drugs.
In several instances, the confiscations put people out on the street who were never charged. Under pressure of lawsuits, the DA's office promised to stop kicking people out of homes, at least until the matter went before a judge. Current DA Seth Williams, who also defends the home seizures, is running for re-election and has four challengers in the Democratic primary. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Philadelphia officially launched its own pre-kindergarten program today. The city began funding 2,000 high-quality pre-K seats with revenue generated by its new tax on sweetened beverages. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron was on hand for opening day.
Sure, it was a little colder than usual, and perhaps a few more reporters were hanging around, but by every other indication, it felt like the usual first day of school at Spin Pre-K in the Parkwood section of Northeast Philadelphia.
Welcome.
Nervous 3- and 4-year-olds hung their backpacks on hooks in the hallway, while teacher Patty Cronin comforted a little girl who missed her mother.
You are mommy. She's going to come back. I promise you, she's going to come back.
At the other end of the first day spectrum, exuberant Ellie Mae couldn't stop rummaging through a box filled with plastic replicas of medical instruments.
This will check your heartbeat.
This will check your heartbeat?
Yeah.
Unlike at the doctor's office, there's no copay here at Spin. Ellie Mae and 39 of her classmates will be here 5.5 hours a day, 5 days a week, free of charge. The city of Philadelphia is picking up the tab of $8,500 per student. Eventually, more than 6,000 youngsters across the city will be enrolled in the program, mostly at privately run centers. Opening day comes exactly a year after Mayor Jim Kenney entered office promising pre-K for city children. It's a milestone for the administration, including the mayor's education chief, Otis Hackney.
I just can't believe that, you know, 1 year ago we were just getting started, and here we are today, getting the children in the seats with a lot of hard work and a ton of support.
That support includes the city council members who voted for a new tax to fund the pre-K initiative. It was an ugly fight, and some questions still linger about Philly pre-K. Some wondered why the city opened the program to all children instead of just low-income kids. Others fumed when the city decided to expand at private pre-K centers instead of unionized public facilities. But for at least a morning, those fights gave way to a boisterous first day at the end of a long road. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrant, WHYY News.
Overall, traffic fatalities in Philadelphia dropped to an historic low in 2016. Good news indeed, save the fact that the percentage of both pedestrians and bicyclists killed is at its highest since 1997. Let's make sense of the numbers with Sarah Clark Stewart, Executive Director of the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia. Sarah Stewart, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
And it was your organization which compiled the data.
Correct. We created a web page and populated it with information about every person who was killed in a traffic crash within the Philadelphia jurisdiction in a real-time way. So we got data from the police department, from media reports, and that way we could track in a sort of almost up-to-date daily basis the number of people who died and then how they died, what kind of crash, and if there was information available, their age, their gender, etc.
Now, clearly, it's inordinately of that pedestrian bicyclist block, pedestrians who are most at risk.
Absolutely. They are the most vulnerable. They make up most of that over 50% who died this year. And it is very worrisome that even though the number of people who are dying in traffic crashes is fell almost 19% this year, the number who died who were pedestrians rose. We've noticed that this is also a pattern that cropped up in New York City, and it indicates that there is a real need to concentrate on the most vulnerable road user and take action to reduce the likelihood that people will die in those kinds of crashes.
Part of the likelihood by virtue of the map is knowing where one is most vulnerable, predictably Roosevelt Boulevard, Bustleton Avenue, and to the best extent safeguard or, if possible, avoid those hot spots.
Well, I think what it does is it really reveals to policymakers that Roosevelt Boulevard and some of these big arterial streets really need action to slow people down. The speed has been at the root of most of these deaths, and it's completely avoidable. And so if measures are taken to make streets safer so that people drive more a little more slowly and keep within the speed limit, they're less likely to have a crash that ends up killing a person.
I'd like to amplify a descriptive you used a moment ago, the term crashes. And indeed, Mayor Kenney's Vision Zero policy declares that traffic crashes, not accidents, are preventable incidents. You know, there's this historic use of, oh, there's a traffic accident on I-95. Almost always, they are not accidents, they're incidents.
Right. They are completely, most of the time, completely preventable and avoidable. And so an accident is truly something that could not have been prevented at all. But in most of these cases, if greater precaution had been taken, the crashes may have still occurred, but they wouldn't have ended up killing someone or severely injuring them. And so that is the idea behind Vision Zero, is to bring down the number of crashes that kill or severely injure people. And it is an absolutely achievable goal, but much effort has to be made both in working on the design of our streets, working on enforcement, working on education through multiple agencies and departments to help bring that about.
Your tenure with the coalition overlaps the administrations of John Street, Mayor Nutter, both advocates and devotees of recreation and specifically mm-hmm. bicycling. Are you enjoying the same support earlier on from the Kenney administration?
Yes, and he has made some very strong commitments to continue installing bike lanes on the streets, to build out the network, to put in even higher quality bike lanes. The commitment is there, and the early commitment has been there since his campaign. In addition, setting a Vision Zero goal, which is what he hopes to accomplish, is to put into place an action plan that will bring down traffic deaths to zero by the year 2030. So he is dedicated to putting in these kinds of measures and these kinds of goals that are ambitious but achievable and that are really going to take the city to the next level.
Sarah Clark Stewart, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're very welcome.
Sarah Clark Stewart, Executive Director of the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. In advance of his confirmation hearing, tentatively scheduled for next week, President-elect Donald Trump's Secretary of State nominee Rex Tillerson is meeting in Washington with Senate Foreign Relations Committee members, and that includes Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons. And at 6:14, we have Delaware Senator Coons on the line. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for a chance to be with you.
And help us take the measure of the man, first on several points, severing ties with ExxonMobil.
Well, I was pleased that Mr. Tillerson has moved promptly to sever all ties with his former employer. He will receive a very significant payout, but as I conveyed to him in our conversation, my concerns really are more about President-elect Trump and his failure to release his taxes and to draw a clear line separating his interests from his company than with Mr. Tillerson, and I hope that the president-elect follows his example of taking a strong action to avoid any potential conflicts of interest.
How about the attempt to draw a clear line given Tillerson's past relations with Russia in general and Vladimir Putin in particular?
Well, that was my main focus of our first half an hour. We spent an hour and a half meeting. It was a very thorough, very generally constructive conversation. But my first question to him was about how he will distinguish between his relationship with Russia and with Putin as the CEO of the world's biggest oil company, and how that relationship would change if he's confirmed to be the Secretary of State, whose role is not producing shareholder value but fighting for America's values. And we had a very thorough conversation about it. I think he sees the differences, but it's a conversation I intend to continue during the public confirmation hearing process.
Moving on, what do you sense from the man regarding his take on climate and the environment?
Well, he's an oil man. He's, you know, someone who thinks we should continue with fossil fuels. Obviously, he's dedicated his whole life to working for ExxonMobil, but is open to the idea that we need to promote renewables as well. I understand that, you know, he's a Republican and is a nominee of a Republican president-elect, and I'm a Democrat. We have different views. I went to the Paris Climate Agreement conference, and I support the climate agreement that President Obama and Secretary Kerry led our involvement in. And I don't think it would have the same degree of support from Mr. Tillerson if he's confirmed. But he did not seem to me to have extreme views on climate or on energy. He struck me as having a more mainstream Republican view that we ought to pursue all sources of energy in the United States, and that energy ought to be a piece of our global diplomatic portfolio. But I, you know, my sense is that we disagree on a number of issues, and the centrality, the importance of climate change is certainly one of them.
Senator Coons, your colleague and ranking Democrat on the committee, Ben Cardin, also came away saying he was in at least some measure encouraged. Are we to think that this will not still be a contentious nomination process for Tillerson?
Well, it depends on how he answers questions in a public forum. There's a number of things that President-elect Trump has said or done in the course of his campaign that are disturbing or alarming about NATO, about Putin and Russia. Is more recent about Russia's attempt to hack our election to influence the outcome of our presidential election. And, you know, Rex Tillerson is the nominee to be Secretary of State. It is important to me that he thoroughly and clearly answer questions about the importance of NATO, how he views Russia and Putin, his relationship, and what kinds of actions he's going to recommend to the president-elect. But the things that have most concerned me that the president-elect has said in the course of his campaign or recently, Mr. Tillerson seemed to have a more balanced view of.
Those concerns do cross party lines. Marco Rubio, for one, on the GOP side, has concerns about Tillerson as well. In our remaining time, help walk us through the process. Now, committee chair Bob Corker, with nominations from Barack Obama, only had the move forward when the committee was unanimous. Is this possible for Tillerson to have a unanimous vote?
I'd be surprised if he got a unanimous vote, but, you know, we'll have to see how it plays out. Because of a change in the Senate rules, it only takes 51 votes in the Senate to confirm a nominee. And, you know, Mr. Tillerson is one of the more controversial nominees because of his friendship with Putin and because of the contention over Trump's statements about Putin and Russia and the election. Possible that Mr. Tillerson will give sort of strong and clear answers about the importance of NATO, about his views on Ukraine and Syria and Russia, and that he'll end up being confirmed. But those statements would really be in some tension with the positions that the president-elect has taken. So it may well end up being a contentious confirmation hearing, because I think there is bipartisan deep concern about Russia's aggression in Syria, about Russia's invasion and occupation of Crimea, and about Russia's attack on our presidential election. I think that's a bipartisan concern, and it will dominate his confirmation hearing.
Had we more time, I'd ask you to weigh in on the controversy over John Bolton to serve as Tillerson's deputy. We'll save that for a separate conversation. Senator Coons, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you.
That's Delaware U.S. Democratic Senator Chris Coons on Newsworks tonight. The Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia has commissioned a local poet to reinterpret the world-famous collection of Impressionist paintings in its galleries. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the poet created an audio guide that's more fanciful than literal.
Dr. Albert Barnes had very particular reasons why he collected so many Impressionist paintings and integrated them with tribal and religious art. His agenda of art literacy is already well described on the gallery audio guide. Now, poet Andrea Hornick has created an alternative interpretation, also available as an audio guide. She was allowed into the galleries on her own, where she used drumming to get into what she calls a trance state, to be able to experience the art with her unconscious mind. Hornick then wrote poems based on those trances.
Turn right from Picasso bulls to face wall with Seurat's models.
The poems describe imaginative relationships between the paintings, which Albert Barnes never intended.
Model refuses to leave Seurat's room inside his head, though is open to small gathering of like-minded women in her dressing room.
Hornick recorded her poems in this dry, monotone style very deliberately. She wanted to recreate the hypnotic state she was in when she experienced the galleries. She says she wanted to set up the conditions so that listeners could discover their own personal relationship to the work instead of being influenced by the official interpretation.
You know, when you walk into a gallery and the museum has great authority and these works are canonical, you know, you want to be able to connect with individual works and have your own experience of them. So this is, in one aspect, a very elaborate scheme to try to make that happen.
Hornick does not want her poetic recordings to be mistaken as an audio guide. This is performance art. It's accessible as streaming audio on users' smartphones until the end of February. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The Philadelphia Water Department has received national recognition for its efforts to control stormwater runoff with environmentally friendly methods, rather than building bigger and bigger sewer pipes. Other cities have taken note and are developing their own green infrastructure projects. From the Allegheny Front, Ashley Murray reports that determining how well these green projects actually work is the next challenge.
John Buck is a soil scientist we met at Chatham University's Eden Hall campus north of Pittsburgh, where Buck was digging holes with a big fence post digger.
22 might be our destination depth.
Buck isn't building a fence, though. He's putting metal sensors into the holes to measure how water moves through the layers of soil.
The sensors are going to be laid in probably about 3 inches below ground surface, 12 inches and 20 inches below ground surface. And from there, we can see how fast it's moving through the soil.
Buck and his students bury the sensors, leaving long wires sticking out of the ground. They plug those wires into a sensor hub, and it kind of looks like a circuit breaker zip-tied to a wooden pole. Thanks to wireless communication, Buck can check those soil readings at any time, right from his phone.
It's telling me that the most recent reading was today at 4:10, and it tells me the status of every sensor.
And that will tell policymakers whether rain gardens, green roofs, or porous pavement can solve their city's water problems.
At a bare minimum, you're going to want to measure how much water is coming into your green infrastructure system and how much is going out of it. And the difference between those two things are what your effectiveness is.
Buck helps monitor several urban projects. One rain garden in Pittsburgh's East Liberty neighborhood captured almost all, 99%, of stormwater runoff last year. It even handled a storm this past August, when the garden soaked up nearly 3 inches of rain in just 2 hours. That effectiveness is important in regions like Pittsburgh, where untreated sewage regularly drains into the rivers after it rains. The Environmental Protection Agency is pushing sewer districts to reduce overflows into the waterways. And in Allegheny County and elsewhere, it's requiring the use of green infrastructure to help solve the problem. There are already a lot of small green infrastructure projects in Pittsburgh and other cities, but the science of monitoring how they work is pretty new. Researchers are still figuring out the best ways to test how well they work.
The more monitoring data that we have, the better we'll be able to determine how successful it is in capturing stormwater runoff.
That's Beth Dutton. She works at Three Rivers Wet Weather. She's clicking on a map that has about 200 little colored dots. Each signifies a rain garden, bioswale, or green roof. She's been cataloging these at schools, hospitals, and apartment buildings, finding them from colleagues or reading about them in the newspaper.
If you click on the blue square, you'll see the project name, the project size, volume, how much roof water runoff is being collected. We went around and we snapped pictures of the installed green infrastructure.
How many of these projects on this map are being monitored?
There are actually not that many that have been monitored simply because it's so expensive to set up the monitoring, and it has to be done over a significant period of time because you want to capture the different seasons, a couple good storms.
As cities spend millions, some billions, on these projects, it's the job of people like James Stitt to make sure they're working. Stitt is with the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. To start monitoring, he says, they need to know how much stormwater is getting into the system in the first place.
We're putting some monitors in the sewer pipes in the ground and getting some calculations on what those annual volumes are in that area before we do anything. Then we're going to continue to monitor that for another year after construction. Every project we do, we want to learn more about how to do this more correctly and more effectively.
Pittsburgh's multi-year Green First plan is expected to keep 1 billion gallons out of the combined sewer system per year. That's about 10% of the problem in Allegheny County. But for people worried about flooding and sewage overflows, there's climate change. It's predicted that storms will get bigger with increased rainfall, but Stitt thinks the green projects will fare well.
One of the great things about green infrastructure is that it's much more adaptive in those situations than a tunnel project or a large pipe project. That's a stagnant solution. It's always going to be that size. The green infrastructure, we can play around with it a little more. It's a little more flexible.
Stitt says cities with more experience have found that as rain gardens and bioswales mature, they actually become more effective. That adaptability is one reason the EPA is pushing for more green projects to help flood-prone regions manage extreme weather. Robert Traver of Villanova University monitors green infrastructure with the EPA in Philadelphia. He says their projects are performing better than expected, even on wet days.
I might be looking at 1 inch of rain or 2 inches of rain. That doesn't happen that often in a year. So if I have a couple more of those events, it's probably going to work. If you have a little more intensity, you have to take a look at it. If I'm talking about a hurricane, that's another story.
For example, Traver said a change in rainfall might call for different types of plants in a rain garden or a constructed wetland.
So in some of the cases, these systems are more resilient and are actually, I think, going to be much better for climate change than some of the past practices that we've used.
He says as storms get more intense, green infrastructure won't be able to eliminate all of the overflows alone. Cities will need a combination of both gray and green. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Ashley Murray.
The Allegheny Front reports on environmental issues in Pennsylvania. This story is part of their series, Headwaters, in partnership with West Virginia Public Broadcasting and funded by the Benedum Foundation. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Many houses of worship, once acting as open doors in their communities, are thinking of how to protect their congregations and facilities from attacks. And tomorrow evening, we'll hear about a new app that helps toward that end. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.